My name is Nada Ahmed, and I am your host for the Braving Innovation Podcast. I believe every company and team can bring new products and services to market and achieve immense success in creating sustainable and profitable business models. Through this podcast, I bring to you inspiring stories, tips, and strategies from leaders all around the world so that you can excel on your journey as an entrepreneur, innovation leader, and investor. Welcome to Braving Innovation.
And I'm really excited because today with me, I have Christian Rangen, who's joining us here from Stavanger, if that's where you are right now. Right. And he, in 2022, was named as the 30 thinkers to watch out for on the prestigious Thinkers 50 radar. He is a top strategy and innovation expert, keynote speaker, business school faculty member, and has pioneered innovation clusters, startup ecosystems all around the world. And we will learn from him about transforming corporate, spurring startup ecosystems, and also his experience mentoring and coaching thousands of startups already now. So welcome to Braving Innovation, Chris.
Thank you, Nada. This is great. And you know, that guy that you introduced, I'd love to meet him. I think you have the wrong guest on the show. I will be that person. But seriously, thank you for the invitation. I think what you're doing is great. Very happy to join.
Thank you. So I wanted to start off with, since this podcast is called Braving Innovation, so I like to ask my guests to talk about a moment. It could be a moment or it could be a time in your life when you felt like you had to be exceptionally brave. It could be an experience. It could be a moment where you had to, you know, be bolder and maybe step up or stand your ground and make some difficult decisions.
Yeah, well, that's a broad invitation. But I'll share three stories. We'll do a deep dive, a walk in the woods, and a company. Because partially I could choose to understand your question as, you know, on the more personal side. And I think that a lot of people, which means my mom, would tell me that I've always had a passion for adventure sports. So scuba diving with sharks and scuba diving with manta rays in very, very sort of remote locations has been and always has been a super fun thing to do. And a lot of people, when they, you know, get a chance to dive with sharks, you know, shark cages or whatever, they think it's a negative, exciting experience. I found the whole thing, and still do, you know, very thrilling, exciting. So getting the chance to swim with sharks and scuba dive with sharks and manta rays is definitely one of those, well, braving moments, I would suppose. Except this one time, we were in Australia. It was a night dive, and we were diving, and we saw this pack of sharks come up and started circling. And you know, the shark behavior you do not want to see is when they start circling you and you're in the middle. And that's when you realize, like, we got to get out of here, like, really fast. And we just dropped our air, sank down, hid under some rocks, and like swam away and hope the sharks don't see us. And that was the only thing that was kind of scary. But the second time was, you know, we were trying to cross Papua New Guinea on foot. Papua New Guinea, of course, being, you know, a remote part of the Indonesian islands. And it turned out to be a little bit more difficult, a little bit more challenging, a little bit more dangerous. And I got sick as a kid, like really, really sick, like sick to the point of, do you have helicopters here? And they go like, nope. However sick you are, you're going to have to walk back out again. It's only 3 to 4 days when you're feeling good. And that was, you know, maybe second time I was like, okay, this was not cool. You know, do not plan for remote jungle hikes days and days from civilization when you get sick. Now, the third example probably is, you know, in corporate settings, we've always tried to push boundaries. We've always taken much more risk, you know, personally, than at least my bankers appreciate. But it's always been done within a framework that we call risk management, a strategy framework. So I think you can draw some parallels from, you know, scuba diving and walking in the woods and what we do in terms of building new companies and building new businesses, because you can manage risk and you can manage, well, dangers, I suppose, but you can do it in a very, well, I suppose, smart way.
Hmm. It doesn't surprise me when you tell me about some of the extreme sports that you partake in, because you can also see that with the activities that you do within business and what, like you said, qualify that as high risk. So could you maybe walk us through how did you find your calling in this space of innovation, startups, entrepreneurship? You know, did you always start up in this field? Were you always curious to enter this field, or you kind of found your way?
Yeah, that was a good question. It's a great question, actually. And I think, so I had a coach once, and I think everyone who's listening or watching this should really think about having a business coach, because a good business coach will challenge you in areas that you didn't really see yourself. I mean, our blind spots. I mean, I have them, you have them, probably. Well, you probably don't have them, but I have them. Most people have them. And a good business coach will quickly identify biases and weak spots, and also kind of what motivates us. What is your engine? And I remember one coach, really, really good one that I had. You know, she and I basically concluded that I'm drawn to the challenge of things. So it's maybe not so much the innovation per se as, hey, that's really difficult, let's do it. Or that sounds really impossible, let's do it. And by its very nature, you know, that is something most people would call innovation. Now, having said that, you know, I do have 20 years of experience, partially in management consulting, partially in academia, where I've been teaching strategy and innovation. So I've always had an academic inclination. I've had a professional inclination. But I think on a personal level, you know, it is being drawn to the challenges and the most difficult problems in the room. And I think that, I mean, also reflecting back on your work, I think if you have people that are constantly seeking out the biggest challenges, and this can be, you know, within an oil and gas company, it can be within a big technology company, it can be within a startup, but if you have people that seek out the most difficult challenges and then get really hell-bent on solving them, that's a good recipe for driving innovation, I suppose.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, that's not something that motivates everybody, right? Some people are happy doing something that's more kind of routine, predictable. Yeah. Other people who are seeking more challenge would not be able to maybe have that patience in that field of work. You know, and having known you for the past couple of years, like you said, you have, you work in a lot of varied environments. You are quite active within academia. You love teaching. You are heavily involved within the entrepreneurial ecosystems within not only in Norway, but globally. You are in many boardrooms. You interact with investors. Out of, you know, all that you do, is there a place or something, some part of what you do that really lights you up, that you find just sort of attracts all that you're really good at and you're just like completely present?
That's a tough question. So let me first say that, yes, I do a lot of different things. And it may seem like a lot of diverse different things, like unconnected, not relevant different things. But to me, you can really draw this line, this connecting line between what I'm teaching in Spain, what I'm advising CEOs on, what I'm investing in with startups, where I'm kind of deep diving into content and research. And it's really the intersection between strategy, innovation, and energy transition. So again, all these things can seem very disconnected and unrelated, but in my view, they are different pieces of the same puzzle. So that's how I see it. Now, what kind of, you know, drives me, I suppose. So I have a challenge, and that is that I tend to get bored very quickly. So if I've done something like twice, you know, I'm never going to do it again. So there's a constant drive to learn and master new things. And our friends at BCG, they have a wonderful phrase, and they've called it competing on the speed of learning. And it basically goes to organizations that will be successful in the future are organizations that are able to learn faster, but not just learn faster, actually compete on their speed and ability to learn new things. And I think I've taken that quote to heart, and that, you know, that that suits what we're trying to do, because if we can learn faster and translate that into concepts and frameworks and value for clients and users, boom, everybody wins.
And I think that is true what you're saying about learning. And I have seen that throughout your journey. You experiment, you try different things, you launch new things. And, you know, I don't like using the word failure, but could you tell us about, you know, when things haven't gone according to plan, how do you handle that?
I don't like to use the word failure either, but you did, so I can use it too, yeah? They're not so much failures as they are unexpected setbacks. And, you know, I could probably list like 10 major setbacks. And I could probably zoom in on 5 of them and say they've largely been related to people. And, you know, obviously those examples will have many sides to the story. And if you ask the people on the other side of those stories, they would give you a different, you know, angle. So it's not a level playing field. But I think where we have been seriously set back, where we've had borderlining failures, have typically been where we haven't been clear enough in terms of aligning expectations and aligning goals, roles. Maybe seeing that there are issues that should have been solved, and we let them slide for a little bit too long. So by the time we actually get into them, you know, it's too late. You crossed that bridge.
What you're describing are sort of like leadership challenges.
People and collaboration challenges, because I mean, you can start something with someone, and then you think you're building the same thing, but you realize like, hey, wait a minute, you know, these guys are actually thinking completely different. You know, did I misunderstand something? Did we choose different paths consciously or subconsciously? You know, where did we kind of step off? But I guess that's you know, you can find that in all sorts of human relationships, whether it's a, you know, a love affair or a marriage, a business relationship, that you take different paths and sometimes you only realize it afterwards.
Yeah, but that's so important, I think, regardless in whatever you do in life in general. It's finding those partnerships and communicating and aligning on what the expectations are or what agreements you've made, right? Because oftentimes, as I've worked with teams, the most important thing is really make sure everyone is aligned, everyone understands. And sometimes you have to go back and reiterate that over and over again, just because you've said it a lot in the beginning, it's not enough.
To give a specific example, which is not my example, I just read about it yesterday. So there is a wonderful venture capital firm in Paris called The Family. And the family had originally 3 founders. And this week, one of those founders, the CEO, she put out a very long text for all the stakeholders and shareholders, etc. And basically, she said, I apologize for having been a little bit unavailable for the last 18 months. But we regret to inform you that one of our co-founders, he has stolen 3 million euro and he won't give it back. Now, we have been trying to fix this internally, and we have now arrived at the place where we have reported him to the police and we've made it a police matter. And you can read between the lines that they had been trying to handle this internally behind the scenes for probably 2 years. I think, you know, when you get into situations like that, they're not failures, but you gotta fix it. So when you get into situations like that, you grab it by the horns and you fix it on day number one. You do not let it fester and wait, because it only gets worse.
Yeah, so you catch something early on and don't kind of wait. You need to address things.
Yeah.
Over your long career, you've worked with a lot of startups. You've invested in a lot of startups. Could you share with us maybe your biggest success story in working with startups, a startup that ended up doing really well over the years that you've mentored, coached, invested in?
So probably my startup investing goes in 3 stages. Stage number one, which was really the first 10 years. So between 2000 and 2010, very slow and learning a lot. sorry, it was a limited number of investments invested into things that I didn't really know about, but started learning stuff.
Angel investing?
Yeah. And then around 2010-11, we started investing more seriously. And over some years, we probably invested, if you look at everything, it's probably about 70 to 80 companies. And out of those, the most successful one so far, at least, has been Zaptec, the EV charging company, which we took. I mean, the first time I met them, I think they had something like three people. And we took that company public about a year and a half ago. And now it's selling in 15 countries. It's been a very, very well-performing stock. And we've sort of been through that whole sort of journey. But then we have sort of phase three, where we're at now, where we have started building venture funds and investing out of venture funds. So now it's a much more regulated environment. It's a much more professional setup. We have, you know, financial restrictions that we need to be aware of. We have limited partners or people that are investing into us. And that's a different stage. And that's still early, but right now we got about 70 companies in total and are going to be very, very, very interesting in 3 to 4 years from now.
Are those 70 companies in your fund currently? Yeah. And what do you look for when you're investing?
Yeah. two answers. If I'm investing out of my own pocket, it needs to be something, you know, exciting, something shiny and exciting. But more and more, we don't do that because of time. So what we're looking for with regards to the more professional side, you know, we have a framework with 12 items that we work through. It's how good is the idea? How big is the market? How much value is there in the market? How strong is the team? What is the leadership? How many exits have they had? What is the exit potential? What's the value potential? We have a very, very strict framework that we work through. But most importantly, it has to fit our thesis. And the thesis that we're looking at right now is the energy transition. Well, during a given week, I probably speak to about 20 companies every week that are, you know, in some capacity within the energy transition. So it can be a offshore wind company. It can be a battery company. It can be a software company. It can be a mobility company. But it's within the energy transition.
Do you feel like within the energy transition, the period for exit, for example, is longer than in some other companies that are just purely tech companies or in a different space?
So I think the answer, it used to be, but it's not going to be. I mean, that's a big part of our hypothesis. Because what's happening now is that pretty much every single big company, whether it's on the utility side or it's the oil and gas side or it's technology side, every single big company realized that the pace of innovation that they have internally, relatively slow, and the pace of innovation that's happening in the marketplace is relatively high. So that means that they are going to have to invest or acquire a lot of these companies. So we're going to see a very, very different M&A market. And we're also going to see a very healthy IPO market for the good companies within the energy transition.
And have you seen a big rise in venture capital towards energy transition, not only within Europe, but also globally?
Oh, yeah. So two big trends right there is one is for venture capital in general. So climate tech funds, that's typically what it's called, you know, when once you go out of Norway. So climate tech funds, they're just raising like record amounts of money, like big money, like serious money. And we're also getting some funds like World Fund and 2150 that are raising their first time clean tech funds. And they're big, like really, really big and very, very smart teams. And the second is the rise of the corporate venture side. So pretty much every company within the energy space, utilities, oil and gas, they either have, they expand, they upgrade, or they build a CVC or corporate venture unit. And take Equinor, for example, just as a random example. So when they first launched their corporate venture capital fund, they had $200 million US that they expected to deploy relatively carefully. And most of that was kind of looking at oil and gas efficiencies or reducing the carbon footprint on oil and gas operations. Now, just for example, Equinor's CVC arm has about $750 million And they're investing very actively in batteries, in solar panels, in charging infrastructure, and all of these emerging areas that they didn't do some years ago.
And when you're working with these companies, what do you tell them about product market fit? How do you know when a company has reached product market fit?
And so the way that you realize the moment you have arrived at product market fit is when you have more inbound traffic than you can handle. And that's difficult. That's really, really, really difficult. When you have more customers banging at your door, drowning your emails, calling you on your private phone at night, when you have more customers inbound than you can handle, that's when you really recognize that you found product market fit. I think a lot of the people, a lot of the companies that say, hey, we have product market fit, not even close.
So people often say it's when your customers become your salespeople because they're so excited about your product.
But that would often refer to like the early pioneers, like your early ambassadors. And that may be a bit of a deceptive product market fit because you're only addressing a very, very small segment of a small subsegment of your total market. So it's more like ambassadors, fans fit than anything else.
And you worked a lot with corporate, helping them slow in this, and that's why they're kind of realizing that they also need to be more involved within the entrepreneurial world so that they can see where the opportunities are. There's going to be a lot more acquisitions happening in the future. What can corporates do to really get that lean startup culture? What have you really seen that is not working in these companies that really slows them down?
Yeah. So, and this is one of the things that you and I have been working on some time back. And companies, when it comes to innovation, they have five plays: build, buy, partner, co-invest, and co-develop. And it's the five sort of innovation strategy pillars that Cisco originally developed and implemented. And when I was working with Cisco, I was very impressed with how strongly this was implemented. And I think most companies are built on a value chain logic with a build, maybe also buy, so that the innovation process is relatively closed and it's relatively focused along the sort of the main business and the core business. I think increasingly, and we're seeing this across the board, companies are learning to partner more actively. They're getting more out of the building. They're connecting with startup hubs and accelerator programs. They are co-investing by setting up CVC arms. And if you look at some of the investments that are happening today in Europe with regards to investing in energy companies, energy startups, you'll see a lot of very active corporate venture teams: Siemens, Shell, Total, BP, NEG. I mean, there are so many, and they're putting a lot of money, and they're partnering on deals, and they're working with VC firms, and they're working with quite a wide range of partners. And then finally, you have types of accelerator programs. So for example, Equinor in Oslo right now is running the Techstars program, where they bring companies from all over the world into the program, including this really cool company I'm speaking with in California. And of course, this is a very different way for a established company to think about innovation when you get into those partner, co-investor, co-develop. And I think that this is, if you will, the way of the future. I mean, every company will have to open up more, accelerate how they think about innovation, and improve how they move from the kind of the closed to the open mindset.
And then within these corporate, some of the work that you've done building the strategy tool platform, which has been amazing, is something that I've used a lot working in corporate. You've made all these different frameworks that is available for anyone to use, open source. And this is a lot of work that you also teach in different universities. And maybe you could elaborate a little bit more on that. But also talking to us about, I really like how you describe how strategy is very different now in this decade to come in the 2020s versus what's been in the past.
Yeah. And now you're really touching, a subject that's close and dear and near to my heart. So take strategy first. So for most people, when you say the word strategy, they think about a corporate setting, board, management, and some expensive consultants. Our hypothesis is that now strategy is everywhere for everyone. You need to have a better strategy, and most do. You need to have a better strategy for your startup or your scale-up. You need to have a better strategy for your innovation ecosystem or innovation cluster, you need to have better strategy for your venture fund. You need to have, you know, we're trying to expand the notion of strategy. And then with regards to the strategy tools platform, you know, we are still early. We're still early with regards to what we want to develop. But we have developed so far about 250 different strategy frameworks and canvases. Most, but not all of them, are currently on the platform. There's always a lot of development and testing happening in the background. We've developed 5 learning simulations that are being used in boardrooms and classrooms around the world. But it's really the community and the people that we're able to sort of pull together that makes us very, well, excited for where this is going.
You mentioned, or I'm not sure if you mentioned, but part of your strategy tools are also these simulations that you do. Yeah. Help people understand how we need to look at strategy in this new disruptive era. But also you've newly launched a new simulation that I was fortunate to be part of called Fund Manager. And we'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. The basic idea that we're developing in strategy tools is that we take complicated topics and we simplify and we visualize. And we've done a lot of work around corporate and corporate strategy, corporate innovation. We've done a lot of work with startups and ecosystems. And then about 2 years ago, we started working on the topic of venture capital. Like, how can we take a very complex topic like venture capital with all of its legal regulations, etc., and simplify and visualize? So last year, we developed a series of tools and canvases. And then also last year, we started developing the fund manager simulation. And we've run that now for a large number of groups, both digital, and we've had one in person that we did last week in London. And we're now teaching this fund manager simulation in multiple business schools in Europe, business schools in the US. I'm traveling to Cairo later this spring to teach how to build venture funds. And I think it's very simple. I think we've been able to take something that is inherently very difficult and complicated, and most people don't know about it. It's a black box. And we've taken that black box of venture capital and we cracked it open. And that's what we're trying to do with the fund manager, the simulations, and also the tools in the series.
And I'm not sure if everyone understands what we mean by simulations. So perhaps you could explain that.
A simulation is a case study brought to life. A good friend of mine in Switzerland said that. We put you in the shoes of a management team, a startup team, or a venture capital team. And then you have to go through basically a simulated experience, but also a competition where you're competing with other teams to win in your respective simulation. Some people say it looks like a super advanced version of Monopoly. It's very visual. It has artifacts and cards and dice, but it's really putting you in the shoes of, for example, a venture capital team, and then having to go through the full 10-12-year cycle, life cycle of a fund, in about 10 to 12 hours. So we take 10 years of learning and we compress it to 10 hours. And it's a lot of fun, but mostly it's a really intense way of learning things.
Yeah, no, and I got to be part of one for the strategy simulation that we did, and also for the fund manager. And I just thought it was a great way for you to learn, and moving away from this textbook kind of just watching on the screen learning to actually doing the work and like embodying those roles. And then, you know, you don't know what kind of scenarios will be created. So really a lot more like real life. And that's when you learn learn the best. So I can see why then this is becoming very successful now. You're taking this to universities all across the world.
Correct. And we haven't really made it official, but if you take that the top 20 business schools globally, I think we checked and we have strategy simulations in almost 10 of those top 20. And we haven't really put that much work in terms of getting it out there, but it's growing. And we are teaching this in London. We're teaching it in several places in the US. We're teaching it across Europe. So give it 2 more years. And I think that we'll have this in the majority of the top 20 business schools around the world. That's kind of fun.
Great. Now we're coming towards the end of our time. So thank you so much, Chris, for today. This was great. I mean, I could deep dive into so many of the topics that we discussed already in. So we'll have to bring you back. There's so much to learn from you, and I'm really excited about Now that you've formalized your fund, really deep diving into energy transition and giving a lot of these founders opportunity to actually make a difference. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. And, you know, finally, a gentle word of advice is for most people sort of in the space of innovation, go swimming with sharks and take a walk in the woods, but having the courage to actually do it is always what I see it coming down to. So for everyone, you know, get that courage and get into more adventure sports in the workplace.
So what could that look like for someone who's working in corporate right now, for example?
Have the courage to pursue the ideas and the option that you see, because everyone I talk to have the ideas of what we could do or what we should do. So innovation in a corporate setting is not about lack of ideas. It's really about lack of courage of doing it. And it may be as specific as walking into the CEO's office and saying, I have a project, I want to present this, and I want you to fund this because I believe it's going to have a big impact on the company. Mm-hmm. Most people would never do it. We can't just do something like that. Well, I invite you to do exactly that.
I think that's very wise advice. And I've seen it from my experience because not many people do that. So when you do that, you stand out. And so if you continue doing what you've always been doing, no one's going to notice you. But if you actually take action on an idea, even if it's not a great idea, but most people are going to want to support you and see where we can take it. So thank you for that great advice, Chris. And I'll see you again soon, hopefully.
We will indeed. And thank you for hosting me. And best of luck with the next guests that get a chance to visit your show. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Braving Innovation Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, do hit subscribe so you do not miss any of our future episodes. Don't forget to leave us a review and share this podcast with others who might find it valuable. Thank you.